Welcome to Anything But a One, Adventures in Miniature Wargaming. Here are your hosts, Tom Castaños, Richard Martinez, and Ray Winstead. Take it away, guys.
Welcome to a very, very special edition of the Anything But a One podcast. And this isn't like the after school special. This isn't the special episode where little Bobby finds out about heroin. This is going to be a little bit better than that. We have the joyous opportunity to work with the folks from the Lead Pursuit podcast. And as dumpy as our podcast is, I can't sit here and say, if you've never heard of them, totally the other way around. I guarantee you've heard of these guys before you've heard of us. But if for some reason you've been under a rock and haven't, you need to look up the Lead Pursuit podcast. Absolutely fantastic content, very blood red skies heavy, but certainly they will talk about other things from time to time. With us today for that are two of the original members, starters of that, and that's Douglas Glover and Brett Cantor. So guys, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, really appreciate being on.
It's going to be a blast. So we bounced around some ideas about what we would talk about, and we kind of settled on the idea of that separation between a war game, a simulation, you know, and there's a range, right, from a game that's a simulation all the way down to what we, you know, affectionately call, you know, the beer and pretzels games that's, you know, one step above Chutes and Ladders, maybe. I don't know. So I'm going to throw it to you guys because we were talking about the Warlord game Blood Red Skies. Once again, if y'all are not familiar with the Lead Pursuit podcast, the gentlemen on the other end of this interview are both professional military pilots. So if anybody's got a take on whether or not an aerial combat war game works, it would be these guys. So give us your take on Blood Red Skies. Douglas, whoever wants to start, yeah. Go right ahead.
Well, I'll start off on that because, you know, my background, since probably nobody knows because they're like Lead Pursuit, never heard of those guys. Oh, wait, those are the guys blackballed for all the explicit language. Yeah, those guys. The one that Google and iTunes won't put their podcast very high up. Yeah, those guys. My background, U.S. Marine, flew F-18s in the back seat. So all the pilots in the crowd will always remind me I'm not a pilot. I'm a backseater, whatever, whatever. you know, I'd played aerial war games of the counter-based variety for years. And I'll always let Brett tell the story of how we got suckered into playing Blood Red Skies. But we both enjoy the game. The podcast members all know how to take a dose of reality with a dose of what makes a fun game and kind of mix the two of them together. And, you know, kind of as a result, that's also why we ended up doing the podcast is as we stumbled onto specifically Blood Red Skies. We said, hey, here's a fun game that seems underrepresented. No one's been dumb enough to do a podcast about it. Why don't we be those dummies?
All right. Brett, what do you want to add to that?
Well, I can't claim to be a military pilot. I was a civilian pilot in college. And, okay. You know, I started flying probably when I was, I was a freshman in college, whatever. But anyway, got my pilot's license when I was in college and flew for a while. But in the military, I was an Army guy. So, I generally know.
He's so modest. He says he's just an Army guy. What, were you in the Army, Brett?
Yeah, I was in the Army my whole damn life. We won't fight about it.
He was a Ranger, so don't let him try himself. Right. He was just some guy.
You know, I generally know which end goes forward on the aircraft, and I've spent plenty of time tumbling out of one. But
by the way, Richard. So Richard got thrown out of a few airplanes down in the Carolinas too. By the way, but anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah, the difference was Richard was drunk though.
Maybe this is a good part to tell the story of how we, like Doug says, how we got suckered into Blood Red Skies.
Sure.
It was kind of by accident, really. We all went together to, me, Chris, and Doug went together to Adepticon some years ago. And while we were there, I was thinking, hey, when we go down to the vendor hall, let's look for a World War II airplane game and maybe something with, like, I don't know, sailing ships. I just wanted to see that while we were buzzing around in the place. We were there playing 30K, right? So, and I hadn't been to Adepticon before, so I didn't know what the vendor hall would look like and stuff. So maybe it's kind of my fault, but we stumbled into the Warlord Games section there in the vendor hall. And of course they had Blood Red Skies with all the model kits and stuff set up there. And so right away I was like, hey, they do have something like that. And it, it, it looked to me like the kind of scale I was imagining in my head. I don't know if I had ever even seen any of the other World War II tabletop games and stuff. I might have seen like, what is it, Wings of Glory? So I was probably vaguely aware that something existed, but I had no idea what the gameplay was like or any of that. So I saw this, I saw the squadron boxes they had all stacked up there for the different factions. And so I knew we were on to something. And, I was kind of geeked out already because, I was kind of hoping, I hope the guys are cool with, I want to be the guy that collects the Luftwaffe stuff. And each one of us kind of had like our own like faction we wanted, right?
Yeah.
So I think we probably right then bought several boxes of stuff and never even played a game. Anyway, John Russell from Warlord Games invited us to come back a little later and play a demo game. And I think he suckered us in with some pizza too, right?
I went for the pizza. Actually, I went to play. I think Chris went for the pizza, but we all ended up buying way too many miniatures.
Yeah, it's usually the way that works.
Super easy setup. He gave us a really basic demo game, but that was enough to get us hooked. I mean, because even without throwing in the cards and some of the other stuff, it was pretty easy to see that this game is fun, but could also give a lot of depth and, I don't know, kind of scratch that collector itch, so I could, there was lots of little planes and stuff that I could paint up.
Well, and let's be honest, part of it was the crowd. So I always tell people that it's important to think of who you have demoing a game. We had bought previously a ton of Dust 1947 stuff and brought that up to play there at Adepticon when we weren't playing Horus Heresy 30K kind of stuff. And if you haven't done Horus Heresy 30K, the crowd there is pretty lively, is the nicest way to put it. So it's a lot of fun. We're used to yelling obscenities at each other across the table, drinking a lot of copious amounts of alcohol while we're playing and pushing our little plastic space marines around. So we took our Dust stuff and went down to the Dust 1947 tables. And it was like a chess match down there. It was quiet. People were serious. They looked like they were really intense. And we kind of stood around and watched and we said, yeah, let's go do that demo game. And obviously John and the Warlord guys were a lot of fun. We were having a good time drinking beer, eating pizza, and they sold us right there.
I had a clarifying question based on what you just said. You talked about, you compared another game system with like Wings of Glory. Was there something about that your group was looking for a squadron-based game versus the way I look at Wings of Glory is more of like an individual type airplane game? Was that why was that scale important to you in that decision?
I was just thinking something around the size that we now have in Blood Red Skies would be manageable in terms of being able to paint stuff up and collect stuff, and it probably wouldn't be super expensive as far as like a barrier to entry would go.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just what was in my mind. Like I said, I didn't know anything about what games were out there. I just imagined that I must have known that I must have seen Wings of Glory, the models and stuff before, but probably didn't know anything more about it. Like I do now. I still don't know anything about Wings of Glory. I would say it's probably maybe somewhat like, the Star Wars game, similar.
That's an excellent point because Ray actually is big into World War I aircraft, so we got started in Wings of Glory because of that. But Ray, your idea, where do they fit in the collector category?
The big problem with Wings of Glory has always been it's hard to get the models.
Yeah,
it. I like the rules; they're very simple, they're very straightforward. I think it works better as a single aircraft on single aircraft game. I've not played the World War II version. But when it comes to the collecting part, it is just very hard because of their.
Yeah, they're like crowdsourced Kickstarter. Oh my God, you missed the Softwood Camel? Well, look on eBay.
If you miss the release and you don't get what you want, it may be years before you see
or never
models again
or never. And there's always eBay if you don't mind paying $400 for a little tiny 1/100 scale
which
airplane.
I'm not going to do.
Nope, not going to do it. The game itself is
think about from our background as Heresy guys, we're used to playing the game with our credit card is the nicest way to say it. You sit there and you go, I have this huge smorgasbord of choices in front of me and I'm going to go, all right, what do I want? I want to play that chapter with those tanks with, and you just pick and build your army and build whatever.
Cha-ching.
Yeah. And however many hundreds of dollars later. So it was nice to kind of walk up to the Warlord table and go, oh wow, I have a game here that obviously has choices. Sure. Some are models, some are plastic. None were resin at the time. But it was a chance to go, yeah, I can build exactly what I want. I'm not going to have to go hunt and search. And even Dust was the same same problem. You walk to the Dust 1947 area, and I wanted to play, you know, U.S. I wanted to build a Ranger force. I really didn't want to build a Marine force. Sorry, been a Marine. Don't really need to make a a Marine army there. But I wanted to build Rangers, and you couldn't get any of them because they were all the original first generation ones that were all out of print. Yep. So, you know, I was not looking to start another game that I had to go find them at Miniature Market on sale or whatever and do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
As Brett talks, we just walked up and Brett's like, hey, I'll play Luftwaffe. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go in for Navy and Marine, whatever, but I'm also going to play RAF. And then, you know, Chris looked over and said, all right, that leaves me with the Soviets. That's easy.
And, you know, the interesting thing about that, too, is it seems like, and you guys can speak to this because you go straight to the well quite often from listening to your podcast, but Warlord seems not only accepting, but very agreeable to all the aftermarket and third-party stuff that's out there. Because, truthfully, Warlord hasn't really released that many different aircraft. But having said that, you know, I've seen your compendium, you know, Ray just was, we were going over it the other day about all of the card based stuff that you guys have come up with. And then you know, you can get every kind of aircraft imaginable in some resin or metal form. Warlord's very, very okay with that, aren't they?
What I would say is I used to think they were more okay than I think they are now. Ooh. And I think there's an interesting problem there, and I've seen it with a couple other Warlord systems, is that when a game really takes off in popularity, then there's a desire to own the models. When a game's just kind of muddling along, they're happy to produce cards, produce, you know, fluff for it, whatever, that people can bring their own stuff. They're never going to show up and say, no, you can't bring other models. That's just not the way that Warlord is.
Right.
But they are also a business. So when they look over and see Blood Red Skies starting to really ramp up in the numbers of people buying kits and buying the expansion card packs, to me, is always the big teller. When people are buying those, then Warlord looks over and goes, oh, maybe it's time to build a model in that expansion card pack and to offer that actually as a boxed kit. And so there is a little bit of tension there that when you have people either 3D printing or, as we have started doing, you know, getting people to build the model and we'll do the 3D print, you can buy the resin print from us. There's a little tension sometimes with Warlord when we say, we're not willing to wait a year, 2 years for you to release that as a box. We're going to do it tomorrow. And they can't operate inside that cycle for a variety of reasons. So as a business, that frustrates them. I get it. I think the good part is it hasn't become let me think how to say this carefully. It has already become confrontational. So between some current Warlord people and some previous Warlord people.
Was not aware.
It has not become it has not become confrontational with the Lead Pursuit / Mariner Games team and Warlord. But that's because we're probably already on Warlord's blacklist. So we can't sink any lower than we already are. Andy Chambers, the game designer, likes us.
That's
John
good.
Russell from Warlord USA likes us. Warlord headquarters may not think we're the favorite people. You know, who knows?
But we interviewed Gabriel Tolentino just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And
I listened to that episode.
Oh, thank you. And you know, they don't have the same problem because, you know, they can introduce different, you know, rates of ships, but ships were kind of ships. You know, it's kind of, you've got your third rate and your second rate. It could be a British ship.
I laughed listening to that whole discussion because it's true. You slap a different bow on a different stern. And, you know, basically now you have a ship from the same baseline look.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, half the damn English ships were Spanish and French ships that were taken anyway. So it doesn't even really matter. You know, El Montaña has now become, you know, this or whatever. It's, you know, it doesn't really matter. So, you know, their release schedule doesn't impact their game nearly as much as the Blood Red Skies release dates on things, which brings us to, so we were at our Millennium Con here in Austin, Texas in 2019, the last time there was one. You know, the pandemic, of course, took the 2020 one. And what everybody was waiting for, because the movie had just come out, Ray and I, while we were at Millennium Con one night, we skipped the Gentleman's Club and we went to the movies and we saw Midway, you know, and what did Warlord say was coming out? Oh, well, this summer, coming summer 2019, you know, the Midway expansion pack. What the hell happened to that?
So Brett can give you his perspectives on it. After I say this, Do any of you guys remember, I would say growing up, but I think Ray was probably middle-aged by this point, the Star Wars Christmas special?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my Lord. Yes.
Yes.
So as I refer to, the mass hallucination that Lucasfilm says never happened, we all remember seeing it. We know it existed, but they have striven to erase all evidence of. I think the Midway starter set is a mass hallucination.
Is it the Mandela effect? Warlord,
yeah, I don't think they ever actually promised it. No, they did. They've had a lot working against them, both of their own doing and of COVID. So, I mean, moving studios never helps production timelines, but they've moved to a much, much better business location. But I'll tell you exactly what Andy told me. He said, I'm personally embarrassed that it has taken us this long. He goes, I can blame a lot of different people. I can blame COVID. At the end of the day, it's just not been delivered, and we'll see when it comes out. I think the last, and I hate to be tied to dates, but the last official date I heard was Easter of this year, which I don't believe.
Yeah, that's coming close.
I am believing it's going to roll out maybe about the time we do Gathering of Eagles down in New Orleans, which is right about the midway anniversary for this year.
He's about to be risen, and I don't have any Devastators and Wildcats yet. So, I mean, they're not going to meld well with Easter at this point in time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Wow. So we'll see. Brett, I don't know, what from everything you've heard, what are you thinking?
I think you're on it. Certainly there were some production delays and all that. I think they're on to something, though. I think Midway and maybe one other that we probably shouldn't talk about are releases or potential releases that are really good for the American market. I think, folks in the U.S. are probably reasonably interested in Battle of Britain, but I don't think it has the same cultural, importance as it does to folks from England. I think Midway might be a little bit more attractive to a lot of potential buyers of the game over here.
Yeah, I know we were excited when we heard it. We still are, and we're still waiting for it to come out.
Yeah, I know the Pacific is a lot more interesting to me personally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it seemed like such a no-brainer to come out with that movie, which, for whatever, not exactly a box office smash, CGI fest, miserable acting. For the most part, there was some good acting in it too, but there was a lot of really bad acting in that movie. But, it would have been a kind of a nice 1-2 punch to come out with that kind of, pop culture reference. But yeah, we've got the War in the Pacific Museum just a couple of miles up the road for, the Nimitz Museum up in Fredericksburg, mm-hmm. Texas. If you've never been, it's actually a remarkable little museum for the podunky little town that it stuck in, which was Chester Nimitz's hometown. But if you're ever in the area, you got to go and check that museum out. It rivals in a very small way the New Orleans World War II Museum in some ways. It's got some excellent, outstanding stuff. So, all right. So what we said we were going to talk about a half hour ago was the difference between like beer and pretzels and simulations. And we went that direction. We started that with the idea of, Blood Red Skies. I don't think I would call Blood Red Skies beer and pretzels.
Oh, I do. I really? Totally do. But go ahead.
No, well, that's cool. No,
they have much better quality beer than we have.
Yeah, I think they do. Yeah, yeah. That's them pretzels with the mustard.
Exactly. I guess the reason I call it beer and pretzels is because you're not flying the airplane. Now, I realize I may have now compressed everything from beer and pretzels to simulation into a very narrow series of categories, but to me, it really is a beer and pretzels kind of game. One, because it's fast. Two, because whether or not it has tactical depth, the tactical depth has nothing to do with the stick and rudder skills or the air speeds you choose or the dive angles or that kind of thing. So that's why I say a beer and pretzels, because it's a good way to have the flavor of an aerial combat game and do it in less than an hour with your buddies and not spend 3 hours just setting up.
That's a good point, because one of the things we've talked about many, many times is the fact that the reason we do this is to get together, above Absolutely. And everything else. It's a social thing. That's why it struggled so desperately during 2020, but it's very much, we are interested in those games that you can sit down, you can play fairly quickly. It doesn't take, days to set up, and then there's still time for the pint, afterwards, in the game. So yeah. Okay. All right. Beer and pretzels. Would you want an air simulation game?
So I don't know what Brett's feelings are. That is why I don't play Check Your Six. I have the rule books, and I was fascinated with Check Your Six Jet Age stuff, and I've read the scenarios for the Kashmir one, for the MiG Alley one. I'm just fascinated with the level of interesting historical detail. That game is what I would say is about two-thirds of the way towards a simulation, and it's already too much for me. Mm-hmm. I don't play DCS as a video game. Why? Because it's as complex as flying an F-18, and I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. That's not fun. You know, so some people may find it really interesting. Not this kid.
No, okay. All right. Yeah,
I have to say.
And I used to play Air War, so I use that. That was a simulation. If you wanted a counter-based, hex-based simulation, Air War was that game, because you tracked every aspect of that airplane.
Yeah, and I have to say, from my own point of view, trying to imagine a true simulation game on hexes with counters, especially for aircraft, it just doesn't work for me. I can almost see it in a computer game somehow, but just you lose
the accounting of it, the just moving little.
Everything just slows down way too much.
And
aerial combat.
Yeah. Well, Brett, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think Blood Red Skies lets you have fun. It's a good time. And there is, like you said, there is some depth to it. So, it can be competitive, right? So you'll get into it playing a game. You're like, oh, man, next time I'm going to get that Joker, right? But I think maybe more than that, one of the things that I've most enjoyed about it is how if you read a book about a particular battle or you see a movie that has scenes from a particular battle or whatever, right? You get something that inspires you, like, man, that is so cool. And you could turn that into a Blood Red Skies game all day long. And that is super fun. So if you get into the camp,
that's cool.
Whether that's more like on the maybe narrative play or campaign gameplay, which I enjoy quite a bit. So it certainly supports that. But even like a more competitive, we've done tournament play at our Gathering of Eagles, and that's super fun too, where you get into list building and trying to like figure out, oh, how am I going to, beat the list that's real prominent right now, that kind of thing. And that is super fun. So you can do all those things, but it's certainly not a bunch of bookkeeping and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. which I think would probably degrade some of the fun. So, you get to paint up models, collect some stuff, and then play in some end of the spectrum of what I just described between like the tournament play, the quick pickup game, all the way up to like maybe some ongoing campaign play where you're really trying to, evolve a narrative. You could do all those things. And at the same time, paint up little airplanes that look just like a particular squadron. And, that's all good times.
And that's, I think, one of the things they struck upon from a marketing standpoint, where, we play a lot of, ground pounder, Napoleonic kind of games, which typically take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miniatures to even get to a starting point. It has a very high threshold for beginners, but we've been doing this, decades.
Centuries.
Well, yeah. for one of a centuries, yes. But yeah, the other
going on centuries.
We're all pretty old, but this race.
And he discovered lead.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Bronze Age really meant little bronze miniatures. But
when I first started painting miniatures, I was able to go, straight to the Greek phalanx and see what they
exactly
were
like. Right. To chisel
didn't
a picture.
Reference photos. You just walked out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Right outside the window. But so great. So for Blood Red Skies, I don't need 100 miniatures to play the game. As a matter of fact, you really couldn't individually. You might be in a big multiplayer game, but
wouldn't want to.
Right. But it didn't stop me from buying 100. So it wasn't a financial failure for Warlord. It just made me want to buy more little factions. I'm doing the same thing in Mortal Gods from the Footsore guys. Only need 30 miniatures. Great. I'll make 12 armies. It's still 300 miniatures.
That's the both good and fun thing that I like about Blood Red Skies, especially since you're doing World War II stuff. The world is your oyster for paint jobs at that point. No one is going to tell you have the wrong Prussian blue. You can sit there and you can do. Chris jokes about it when he does his Eastern Front Russian stuff. He's like, look, it's chipped, it's weathered, it's it's got a wash over it, it's got dirt. Or when you're doing like Pacific stuff. I mean, every Navy and Marine Corps squadron, it seems like, had different colors that they were using. And then some of them were faded because they hadn't been repainted in a year and a half. You know, all those kind of things that it gives you an opportunity to keep acquiring and building.
Yep.
And at some point you end up either like Brett, who I think has collected every 109E in World War II and painted it. Oh, or you end up...
Yeah. I'm literally looking at, I think, what I think is my 7th or 8th squadron of Luftwaffe bombers.
Wow.
Bombers are free in the game. Like, you don't even... Like, they have cardboard chits.
Right.
In the start for bombers. They're not even... You know, you don't even pay points to play the bombers. They're just like... Every once in a while, you might have an airstrike scenario where there's some bombers you might escort or something. Well, yeah, I've got, like, I think 7 or 8 squadrons of bombers now, just because I think they're cool and I want ones for this particular, you know, squadron or whatever. It's
well, nuts. And so you get the other end of the spectrum, me, who doesn't paint nearly as much. So I end up with what we call rainbow squadrons, because I'll paint, you know, sections, pairs of aircraft up. So I'll buy a box of 6, but of my 6 Wildcats, 2 of them are Fleet Air Arm, 2 of them are U.S. Navy, and 2 of them are U.S. Marine Corps. So, okay. You know, I don't have when I field a squadron of 6 people, are like, hey, those don't all look the same. I'm like, yeah, no kidding. I get bored painting 6 little airplanes the same.
Dude, go to Napoleonics. Paint like 400 white clad Austrians one day and realize you still don't even have enough for a basic game, right?
Like my friend Leslie, I'll do Napoleonics in 2mm scale. So I can put a block out there and paint it a single color.
Yeah. No.
My solution to painting aircraft is spray paint.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I've got gray and intermediate blue. You know, you flip it one side, then you flip it on the other side.
It's like grilling steaks.
I kept doing the same thing with my airbrush with all the U.S. Wildcats, is I would get it close enough with the airbrush and just base coat it to what I wanted, knowing I was going to do a wash and all this other stuff, and then finally go back and, when I got the airplane to where I wanted to, actually touch it up with a brush to make it not look like a total hack job. But it got me through painting them that much faster.
So when I think of Beer and Pretzel, so, you know, we talked about Wings of Glory. We played that. It's a good game. There's nothing wrong with the game. It's all about the way Ares Games chooses to distribute their castings and their miniatures. But, you know, when it comes to the one thing that when we first were kind of introduced to Blood, when I read about Blood Red Skies, it didn't interest me at all. I went, fuck, that sounds dumb, right? You know, and then we also
I wish I'd said the same, but I fell for it.
We also got suckered into a game at Millennium Con and enjoyed it. Oh, my God. All of a sudden, you realize the subtlety of your position on the little base and all of these kind of things. And then all of a sudden you're doing what we want to do in all of our war games. We're spending more time thinking about how we're going to defeat that loser on the other side of the table than we are about flipping through rules and trying to out lawyer the other guy. Oh, but you don't remember chapter 9, section 21, where I can, you know, it's more about actually putting yourself in the mindset of playing. And then I say, in fairness, Wings of Glory does the same thing. It's geometry. It's being able to kind of second guess what you think your opponent's going to do and find the right angles to, you know, it's kind of like playing pool at that point in time, being able to visualize where you want to go. And the more the rules allow you to get in that mindset, I think the more effective they are, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I keep trying to think through what makes it unique. What makes the fun part of it where you're not overcompensating mentally for figuring out what each of the pilots is doing. I think it's the fact that you've got the advantage and you're able to take a look at what the card mechanic is, what the advantage mechanic is, and then what the physical move is. So I kind of separate the three of them in my mind. And that gives you the tactical depth, because now you have more than one way to do something dastardly to that guy across the table.
Yeah.
You wait for your last little section to you know, change your advantage or whatever. Yeah. All of a sudden you thought they thought they had you, and then no, then out comes the card, out comes the whatever.
As we talk about Brett, he plays what we call the Blue Falcon list. And if you don't know what a Blue Falcon is, the first word is buddy, and the second word you can figure out on your own. But the point is, Brett plays to a way where it's not necessarily that in his competitive list, he's going to physically move his airplane to that shooting physician, he's just going to deny you all your shots, deny you all your attempts to climb for advantage, and he's going to make your life miserable to the point where he will eventually wear you down, you'll make a mistake, and he'll win the game.
But that's a win.
Yep.
Right. I win by making the other guy step on his own poncho, right?
Exactly.
I think the word scoreboard, baby, is all that matters. It doesn't matter how you got there. I had this first profession a million years ago. I had an announcing teacher in college, and she had been one of the original, like, girl next door in the Coca-Cola commercials in, like, the 1970s. I like to teach, with those. And she was from Atlanta because, of course, Coca-Cola was from Atlanta. And now she was in her 50s when I had her for this class, but she was still this very elegant Southern belle kind of woman. And she ended every class, I promise this has a point, she ended every class with the same saying. She said, "All right, ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to remember, it's not how you drive, it's how you arrive." And that is so very true in these kind of games. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you don't get style points for shooting somebody's eyeballs out. You win.
When the other guy run away.
When you make the other guy run away. That's a win like anything else is, right? But
it brings up a good thing about Blood Red Skies is that, you know, not only do the aircraft play reasonably differently from each other, but the mm-hmm. factions certainly do. If you think about, like, Luftwaffe fighters in the different periods during World War II, the aircraft were, you know, maybe they weren't as tight turning, but, you know, maybe they had great climb performance. And, you know, some other things like that are represented, I think, very well in the compression, in the mechanics and stuff of Blood Red Skies. So if you're, you know, I play the way I do because I like to play Luftwaffe, and they're not the most winny airplanes, right? They're not the auto win airplanes. They don't have all these fancy tricks and tight turns and things like that that you can put together to really be pretty, pretty nasty. So I have to find ways to use the strengths and traits and stuff that my planes come with. And I think it's fun. It just makes it super fun. It's appealing to me.
You know, I would agree. It's like trying to find the solution to a puzzle. You got to find that niche in your play style that works well with that faction. You could have the best planes, but if you don't play to their strengths, you're probably going to get very marginal results.
In our group, Richard's far and away the most analytical of us. I mean, he would be the one that read all the cards the night before and calculated this plan of how to put it into perspective. And Ray and I are way more the Leroy Jenkins kind of, like, just, we'll fly out there and see what happens.
Richard's the math guy.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and it shows up. I mean, and it doesn't happen often, but that one time that some just perfectly random, ridiculous thing that Richard couldn't possibly account for happens, you lose it a little bit because you like order in your world, you know, but you account for the fact that there's not complete order, but when it goes completely south, and it's rare that it happens on him because he's so prepared, it's kind of comical. But
well, you know, one of
Richard, I feel your pain. I am the math hammer guy of this group. There so, and Andy has lost his mind on me. Oh yeah. Well, Andy's lost his mind on me a couple times because I've said, "Andy, it's not physically possible in this scenario on an average day for, you know, side X to win." But that's how I walk into a lot of these things and look at what are the basic dice odds that are going to lead me down certain tactical decisions. And then I can sit there and go, okay, I know that, you know, I'm a vulnerable fighter rolling firepower one against a robust fighter. I know that it's only my pilot skill that brings this. So I'm not going to fly any pilot skill two guys because the odds of me rolling six between two dice, slim to none, and he just left town.
Yep.
So, I have to look at the world that way. But like you know, Brett has laughed when everything has gone south as I'm flying those tight turny fighters, you know, the RAF Spitfires over Malta, and his Luftwaffe and RA force just comes and steamrolls me.
So other games out there. I mean, so we're talking about Baron Pretzels versus, you know, the kind of simulated games. What else is out there that you guys are playing that, you know, keeps you happy, that makes you happy?
So you're going to laugh because it's a solo game. And it, in my opinion, it is super beer and pretzels because it really has nothing to do with aviation, but it's fun. And that's DVG Games Phantom Leader. And I don't know if anyone's played any of their leader series. Any of you guys?
They have a tank game too, don't they?
Yeah, they have Tiger Leader and Sherman Leader.
Okay, I know about those, yeah.
Yeah, and the Leader Series games at their core are asset management games with history sprinkled over the top. we could argue till the cows come home about Hornet Leader and Phantom Leader. Do they simulate air power either during Vietnam or during the modern era? Who cares? Because are they fun?
Yeah.
That's where I go back to. That's, I classify those as beer and pretzel games because it's something I open up on a, you know, on a night where I only have 1 or 2 hours to play. I can quickly generate some missions, generate some pilots, have some fun, feel like I did a little bit of wargaming in the solo variety now rather than across the table. And it gives me a flavor of something from a historical era. Could I sit there and overanalyze it as a former F-18 aviator? Yeah, yeah. And I've done that with Hornet Leader and lost because I thought about it like I was planning a strike mission, not playing a game. But you know, that's one of the ones that I've enjoyed doing in the beer and pretzels variety.
You know, we talk all the time. So we started years and years ago in Napoleonics in the Empire rule system written by Scott Bowden. And that one hinged closer on being a simulation, although it's still a game. And we all have cold sweat memories of being far too young and far too stupid to be reading these rules and what we got out of it. And someday I just threatened the other day, I'm going to find Scott Bowden, get him on the show to interview him. We've talked so much crap about this poor man's rules, and they are beloved in some circles of the world, but they all had these flow charts where, like, your skirmishers, if your skirmishers are this far from your parent battalion, if then this, then it's like, whoa, it just was.
So it's a Napoleonic advanced squad leader is what you're saying.
It was. And it's funny. We just mentioned advanced squad leader in the last episode we recorded. It's like, yeah, that needed therapy.
I loved
that
ASL, just, but I lost years of my life to that game.
So did you ever play the little booklet game, the wing? What was it called?
Ace of Aces.
I actually never did.
Oh my God.
It was a great game.
Beer and pretzels.
That's the ultimate beer and pretzels game. And we love that game. And I went looking for them on eBay and they're like $200 a pair right now.
Crazy expensive. Because I remember when they came out and I was talking to Mitch Reed from No Dice, No Glory a couple months ago about those. And I'm like, yeah, they can't be that expensive. And I went out on eBay and I was like, oh my God, they are that expensive.
But they were fun. And that's another one where you were successful. If you could visualize yourself in that cockpit and understand the geometry of where those turns that you know, limited number of potential pages you were going to turn to. But if you could do those two things, you could come up very successful in that game. But it was, you know, play it anywhere. You got the two stupid little books, you know, it could be a backseat of a car game and on a road trip. That was an amazing mechanic. That was really well and probably pretty complicated to, I guess that was all designed off of flow charts too.
And that's what I always wondered with that one is how did that mechanic get designed? Because it's easy to see how it got produced, but how do you sit there and figure out the correct orientation of all those things throughout the pages?
You had like 12 choices, which led to these combinations. But if you're playing against someone, they've got 12 choices too. And I'm Richard, that's a lot of opportunities. That's a lot of potential.
I just remember all the times we were all flying away from each other because we wanted to go left turn and we wound up going right.
Yeah.
You could never get it right.
Yeah. But it was, that was an amazing little beer and pretzels game that, you know, it generated hours of enjoyment, which again, you know, ultimately, heaven forbid these games are fun.
Exactly. And I was, so in a sense, I was going to turn the question around on you guys and say, defend to me why either Pike and Shot or Black Powder is not a beer and pretzels game. And if the answer is no, it's not, is it simply in the setup and not in the playing? Or what makes that, I don't want to call it historical, because it's historical light, I guess, is the best way, because it's not a simulation, but it's fun, but it's enjoyable, and it has the flavor of history.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I was thinking back on the question when we asked you between beer and pretzels and simulation, and I realized I really didn't take that word simulation seriously enough when you started mentioning the games that you did. I was really putting it in a spectrum of easy beer and pretzel games and more difficult beer and pretzel games. And that's why I think when Tom was saying Ace of Aces for us would be that little light-hearted beer and pretzels, and you know, Blood Red Skies is a more complicated one because it did involve more thinking than, let's say, just Ace of Aces. Pike and Shot, not a simulation, as you said. For us, I think one big aspect of appeal to us is it got us into that genre. We'd been talking for years about getting into English Civil War, 30 Years' War, games and had gone through several sets and never been successful in getting it into it for whatever reason. That's the one that brought us in. I think that's what the appeal was to it. And it and a lot of the mechanics involved, it reminded us of all the battles that we had read about when it came to those time periods. And for us, it's the one that stuck to us. It's the one that finally brought us into a genre we had been wanting to get into for decades.
Yeah. And Brett mentioned something that Ray's going to hit on about that end result about movies and TV shows and things like that.
It plays the way I imagine the time period to have been, whether it's terribly historical or whether it comes from movies I've seen. Really with me, it's more books I've read. If a game plays like I imagine it should play from the books that I've read about the period, I'm generally going to gravitate towards it.
Absolutely.
That's to me a simulation. I want to be Walter Mitty. I imagine myself in the goofy looking uniform, actually leading guys up and down the battlefield and dodging cannonballs.
I look at it slightly differently because I was going to say I think for me I define that as a fun game. If it if it brings out what I imagined the conflict would be like, even from what I've read, what I've studied, etc. To me, it becomes a simulation when I can start with the same initial conditions and come with the same outcome. I know I can't do that with Blood Red Skies. I know that won't happen. In some cases, I would say even with like Check Your Six, it might or might not happen. You probably have a 75% chance that it actually will happen that way. And I think that's what really, you know, splits the difference for me is because I think of Advanced Squad Leader, something that was so minutely crunched down to the numbers that generally when you sat there with a Tiger tank and you shot at Sherman, you got, you know, the exact effect that you would have gotten historically as you went cross-referenced through all the tables for your weapons and everything. Whereas, you know, at least for me, I don't need that level of outcome. I've played those games. They're fun, but gosh, a lot of times they take too long.
I think you're right. And so you're absolutely correct. When I was thinking of it, I didn't assign that level of thought for a simulation. I know this is one thing that I know we do have some difficulty in applying in our games too, is sometimes even though it's not a simulation, we do have some difficulty in getting what we perceive the history of that time period and just letting it go and have fun with the games. We've had several games we've had problems with because it's not what we believe should have happened.
I'm glad.
Are we going to talk about Team Yankee again?
No. Well, I was going to say,
no Team Yankee.
Brett and Doug were describing is they understand the limitations and still are willing to have fun with it and let it go. And we've had problems with that in the past, even though we were never there and never did it. Based on our readings,
that's an excellent point. You know, that's where I was going to go with this. What qualifies something as beer and pretzels to me in a simulation has everything to do about my knowledge base on the subject. Because if I don't know squat about it, and that goes into like Dark Ages combat, I play some probably pretty beer and pretzels damn games and go, damn, that was just like the real thing. You know, I don't know. I watched Last Kingdom and I want to jab Uhtred in the head with an axe, then boop, that's it. You know, but I've spent a lot of my time in multiple languages studying Napoleonic combat, and there are some watermark things that I expect in a set of rules because of my knowledge base on that, which drives home. So to go back to the Black Powder reference, we've played Black Powder and we've talked about, oh, that's great for this, that's great for that. Then we played a Napoleonic. We stood around going, look, wow, where was the meat? Where was the flavor there? There was none, you know?
Well, I think the original question on what separates Warlord games, you know, from fun as compared to simulation. And I think with Warlord itself, Pike and Shot, Black Powder especially, I think a lot of it in those games is the attitude that the players are bringing to the table. I think they're very playable as fun beer and pretzels games, but I think there's enough meat in the rules that more serious players can bring that to the table and actually manage to play a pretty serious game there also.
Well, and I think it you just guys depends said it on best what when the, you
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when you guys were discussing Warlord games in general several episodes ago, you really kind of came away and said, you know what, the point of their games is to not always give you the historical outcome. You can sculpt the game to get the historical outcome, but yeah. Generally the point of a lot of the games was to get you into the history so that maybe 3 or 4 or 5 games later, you would play one that you would sculpt to the right historical outcome.
Right. I didn't have to learn 9 game systems to play everything from the Zulu Wars to the Wars of the Spanish Succession. You know, just with a few tweaks, I could drop off and play something completely different. So, yeah, it's got that. But then when you hit that home space where you're the most comfortable, just like you said, playing, you know, Phantom Leader versus Hornet Leader, you know, all of a sudden your background of information makes one a little less crunchy than the other one because you can say, that's not the way that works.
And I think that's it. I think those games can be as historical as the players want them to be. But if you're going to play very historically, you do have to put some work into it.
Yeah, yeah, that's not out of the box.
You're
going
to have to do a little bit of research. You're going to have to actually read a book or two. But it's, I think there's enough meat there that you can pull it off if you want to do it.
I think it's interesting when you come to more modern games, so World War One. Well, I would say World War Two. World War One's getting, you know, 100 years past now, and then some. But there's a lot of room to fudge the Dark Ages because, you know, what are you dealing with as your historical research? That a poem, you know, written by an illiterate scribe in, you know, 1194, and he does that verily stab 3 men with his broadsword. That's really not the basis of a good
Ray had learned to read and write by that point.
No, he was way more barbarian.
He was still reading chicken bones.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, not so much better than I do now, I promise.
But when you come to like World War II aircraft, then you get into a whole different set. There's statistical data out the wazoo, but there's also a lot of kind of nationalistic pride.
Yes, there is.
Urban legend-y kinds of things that have to be overcome. Do you feel like that's a big thing with those? I mean, on the Facebook group, I really haven't seen a lot of like horrible debate, but I'm sure people argue whether or not.
So, well, people have been good in the Facebook group. I will say that. Brett, what is your take on that as the guy who's been on the receiving end of that debate?
Let's see. If you're not RAF, you don't get tight turn. That comes to mind.
The litany of, and I'm going to call them excuses because I'm going to be mean. The litany of excuses why either Luftwaffe, Soviet, Italian, and American planes all got pigeonholed into less than optimum performance in blood red skies is hilarious. And the problem is, even at the end of the day, I'm not an F-6F Hellcat pilot. I've never flown an F-4F Wildcat. I've taken plenty of photos of those airplanes, never flown one. But I have to go back and from my knowledge base, read the accounts and read the test pilot things. And I would argue, slightly more experienced at reading those things than people who do not have a background in aviation.
Right.
So it has been painful to me in a sense when people have brought up points that are like, hey, man, how can the... How is it that the Hellcat that was designed to defeat the Zero, basically, how is it just such a brick in this game? And I've turned around and go, that's because there's a belief that all radial engine fighters are low performance, which is not at all the case. If you've ever seen a Hellcat or Bearcat fly, oh my God, those things are amazing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure a Corsair was a radial engine too, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, and I even laugh about the Corsair because there was a point in the rules where the Corsair and the Hellcat's statistics were almost identical. And so two planes that fly very differently flew the exact same in the game because there was a belief that all big American radial engine airplanes were bricks with wings. Not at all the case. Thankfully, there's been some reshuffling. The traits and some of the data for the Hellcat has been changed. Well, the Corsair still flies like a brick with wings, but that's all right. I don't care. I'll beat people that brick with wings.
Yeah, right, yeah. Bricks hurt.
But you know, they hurt too. But there is a lot of cultural baggage in there. And words mean things. So here's the problem. When you assign a trait like poor quality, and the outcome of that trait is to simply have a negative impact at the start of the game. It doesn't have any impact after the game has started. It just simply makes you more likely to be less advantaged at the start. But then think about that as an Italian player who is also Italian, who looks and sees these airplanes and go, why do you say poor quality? Those airplanes, they didn't have a radio. That's what it was. They were poor quality airplanes. Yeah. Or my Russian friends who have said, how come most of the Soviet planes have poor quality? And you go, yeah, well, Andy, Ken, you guys want to defend that one?
Yeah.
But the reason a lot of them had that trait was because they either didn't have radios or they were flown open cockpit. And so people didn't coordinate the start of the attack very well. And so as a result, they were generally more disadvantaged than their radio and closed cockpit equipped counterparts. So we've also had to fight through that. There's nationalism, there's poor word choice, and then there's just... I will give people the benefit of the doubt. Incomplete research. in other lines of work, you would say faulty research or fake news.
I watched every episode of Black Sheep Squadron, and I know that.
Twice, because I got the DVDs.
That's right.
And I think one of the best discussions came up talking about the ME-163. And all the information that people were standing on were these, I believe it was two test flights done in the United States at the end of the war, where, first of all, they didn't even take off. They were towed behind a B-29, and it nearly departed controlled flight and crashed because it was not meant to be towed by a B-29 with those big engines. And so they only dropped it from, I think, 30,000 feet, let it glide down. So two flights of that were the entire data points that are written about historically by Westerners. And nobody wants to read what the Luftwaffe said, because why would we want to read what a bunch of Nazis said about their own airplane? Sure, they've got to be lying.
Skewed.
You know, come on,
fake
guys.
News.
The truth is somewhere in between.
Definitely.
Yes. Yeah. I got a question for you. What are the house rules that Lead Pursuit uses in Blood Red Skies? Y'all have anything? Or y'all just depart from the game that you don't really discuss openly?
Do you pretty much play it out of the book? No, we don't play it out of the book. So we house rule a lot, but we house rule it in two different ways. And Brett, please back me up on this, especially if I forget something that we've house ruled. The first one that we play with a lot of times is we change the deflection boom chip mechanic. So normally, anytime you shoot and you roll and you hit a guy with a deflection shot, you award a boom chip. In Doug's world, that's just not fair. Deflection shooting close enough to scare somebody is a skill. So we had gone to using the mechanic that it took a critical hit. So you'd have two successes out of your dice that you rolled to actually award the boom chit.
Okay.
And I like that. Is it an ugly rule? Is it a Band-Aid? Yes, it is. Andy has put that rule into, as they call it, Big Red Skies, the 172nd scale variant of Blood Red Skies. Because it does tend to make the game a little bit longer, and it doesn't mean people can take low probability of hit shots, and without ever really being disciplined and influencing the game, they can end it for your squadron pretty quickly. Brett, I'm obviously forgetting some other house rules that I know we've used. I know you and Steve probably have house ruled a lot in your campaigns.
Yeah, you know, I'm struggling to think of anything that we completely leave the reservation on. I know we use the optional heavy fighter rule pretty regularly.
Yeah.
Which, you know, makes fighters that have twin engine fly more like fighters than bombers, so that they're a little harder to shoot down than, there's some twin engine mechanics where if you're shooting a twin, I think the intent there is if you're trying to shoot down a bomber, you can shoot them from pretty much any attack angle.
Yeah, it makes my P-38s feel more like a fighter than a bomber.
Right. So that's written into the rules, and we've adopted those. But it's not like it's a full departure. I mean, it's a suggested rule thing in there. We do that. Doug already talked about the critical success on the on deflection shooting. I almost forgot about that. We do that. Doug did mention that Steve Toth and I we don't so much have house rules, but we've kind of bolted on some stuff for some ongoing narrative campaign games. It's actually something we've been working to to kind of publish over the past year. We've sunk hundreds of hours now into writing down what we've adopted to make games link together so that you can, you know, instead of just playing one game and it being fun, okay, that was great, but it's not connected to any other subsequent game. We've found a way to really have a lot of fun making a campaign happen where each game applies, you know, the results of those games apply to the next game, and so real stories start to develop, and even real characters start to develop out of the individual pilots, where before that kind of thing wasn't really happening. I mean, even in my painting and collecting, wasn't really thinking about individual pilots too much, unless I was trying to paint a specific ace pilot, which, you know, that's a thing in Blood Red Skies. There's named aces and you can paint their planes. But, you know, beyond that, I was just painting squadrons, right? Well, man, now in campaign gaming, we found that as we play individual quote unquote pilots, I'm doing my little quotation fingers here. They sort of develop some kind of funny character, if you will, because things start to happen and you start to assign some, you know, some, I don't know how to describe it, like personality.
You have an emotional attachment. So yes. I tease Brett. I'm like, apparently you didn't play enough Dungeons and Dragons as a kid so that you can't bring D&D into Blood Red Skies.
You know? That's what it's turned into. Yeah. And that's been pretty fun. And so I don't know if it's actual house. Well, I guess it is house rules because these, you know, we've basically cobbled together from three or four different sources from other games and even from within Blood Red Skies and come up with a way to just make this fun narrative thing happen over a long score of games. And I don't know that it's so much like the actual gameplay itself is the same, but we've added a couple little things.
I like the way you phrase that. It's simplistic. It's elegant how you talked about you bolted on to a narrative campaign. When we've tried house rules, another thing that we always argued about was, you know, how does it change the overall impact of the game? What happens if you get outside the group and then you've got to re-remember things? But when you put it and you compartmentalize it that way, the way you mentioned it, it's only going to apply to a set series of games or when it's agreed to that you're going to be playing within that campaign system. And otherwise, it's a bolt-on. It comes back off if you ever play the base set rules again. I guess we've never thought of it that way. It's always an all or nothing for us. It's a house rule forever.
Well, I definitely want to say that, you know, we were just talking about, we were brainstorming future episodes, and we were talking about we want to do one very soon on campaign systems. And man, mm-hmm. I'd love to have you back to join in on that discussion, because, you know, that's the one thing that so many of our games have lacked is that place in the bigger world and the consequences where you don't have every game doesn't end in the bonsai charge at the last turn to get to the objective point, because, you know, you might want to have some of those guys later, you know, like for the next battle or things like that. Gives it some sense of you know, I hate to throw around a word like realism, but I mean, it does put it in context of a larger world.
Oh yeah. Our campaign games have definitely definitely changed our gameplay style in certain games. You know, you go into an individual scenario where you're really on the back foot, you might not take the same kind of risks you would take if you were, you know, just playing a one-off game. That's definitely a thing.
Yep. Hey, you know what, guys? We're way over our normal time limit, but it's certainly worth every
fun.
Minute.
Yeah. It's like it's flown. It's been great.
Flown? With pilot? All right. We got to do this again. Soon.
Yeah, anytime. We always enjoy talking with you guys, and I appreciate you having us on the podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
We're happy to monopolize.
Can we come play on yours sometime? That might be
fun.
Yes,
and guess what? You can use profanity on ours.
Oh, wow.
E rating.
We'll have to practice our swear words because we don't talk exactly. Like that. Hey, guys. So, again, we had Douglas Glover and Brett Cantor from the Lead Pursuit podcast. Outstanding, guys. Outstanding podcast. Again, if you've not listen to Lead Pursuit, you need to go do that immediately. It is all things Blood Red Skies, and at a level so far beyond what I think even Andy Chambers ever thought that game would become. So thanks, guys, and we will see you again very soon. Hear from you very soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Once again, appreciate having everybody out there. Follow and share this podcast. Rate us if you can. Click that heart button and buy us a beer to help support things. For Ray Winstead, Richard Martinez, I'm Tom Castaños. Have a great day.
This has been Anything But a One, Adventures in Miniature Wargaming. Find us on all your favorite podcast apps or on our webpage at anythingbutaone.buzzsprout.com. Please subscribe to the show and rate us 5 stars. And of course, tell your friends. See you next time.